Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands.
We're so excited that today's episode is sponsored by Project Entrepreneur, a program by UBS that accelerates the growth of female-founded companies by increasing their investment readiness and connecting them to the resources and networks they need to build and grow their businesses. The Riveter has been a part of Project Entrepreneur in many different ways, and it is an incredible program. In fact, since its launch in 2015, Project Entrepreneur has supported more than 1,800 female founders who've gone on to raise nearly $55 million in funding.
Please stick around to the end of the podcast and meet one of the founders of Project Entrepreneur, Jamie Sears, head of UBS Community Affairs and Corporate Responsibility. Jamie's story is incredible and you won't want to miss it. And now we have speaker and author Lovey Ajayi Jones. She is here to celebrate her newest book, Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual. Lovey, you grew up in Nigeria. What was your childhood like?
My childhood was normal. You know, grew up in a household, a loving household in Nigeria with siblings. Yeah, I mean, it was fine. I actually don't even know how to answer that question.
What did you worry about as a kid? What were you insecure about?
Damn, that's a good question. I don't remember being insecure about much.
What was the contrast like when you got to America and started your life here with your family? Do you remember that as being a seismic event?
Yeah, I mean, moving from one continent to another, a warm place to a cold place, a place where everybody was Black, and then here, only a little bit were Black. It was absolutely a major culture shift and a momentous change. My accent was different for the first time. My name was different for the first time. And it was definitely the first time that I was the new girl anywhere. So yeah, that was absolutely a huge shift.
How did you adapt to being the new girl?
I listened to the other kids talk, and I lost most of my accent in a few years. I didn't go by my first name, which is Ifeoluwa. Now it was Lavette. But I still brought my jollof rice to school. I still spoke Yoruba most of the time at home. But yeah, I think kids are very adaptable. So I pretty much adapted pretty easily, got friends, and kind of blended in after a bit.
And what was your relationship with your siblings like then compared to how it is today?
My relationship with my siblings hasn't much changed over the years. We've always been close. So that hasn't been a big shift or anything like that.
What do they do? I mean, you're so in the public eye. Are they in the public eye?
No, not at all. My family is pretty private. They are definitely not public in any way. And they're regular people. I'm a regular person, but they're definitely not visible.
What do they think about you being in the public eye?
My family is really supportive. They're vocal about, you know, loving what I do. They're really proud.
Tell us about your evolution to becoming a blogger.
Yeah. So when I started college in 2002, my major was actually psychology pre-med because I thought I'd be a doctor. You know, that was the dream. That was the thing that I wanted to do. And I started school with that intention. And then I took chemistry 101, and that dead the dream because I ended up getting a D. And it was the first D of my academic career. It was kind of shocking my system because I was definitely not used to failing, and I considered a D failing. I was not used to not getting the grade I expected. And I think it was a moment of realization because I was like, yo, you actually tried and you failed it. So you probably don't want to be a doctor. And I actually really did realize in that moment that I did not want to be a doctor, that it had been a dream that was not necessarily mine, was kind of like passed to me. And I dropped it. I instantly dropped the pre-med.
Who was it passed to you from?
Family, friends. I mean, I'm Nigerian, so being a Nigerian, they, you know, doctor, lawyer, accountants are pretty much things that you're encouraged to do. So I was like, oh, I'll pick doctor. But that semester, I actually started blogging. So yeah, as one dream was dying, another was being birthed. And then, so I had my blog all through college. After I graduated, I deleted my college blog and I started awesomelylovey.com to talk less about myself and more about the world as I see it. And I just never stopped.
What blogs did you read before you started your own?
None.
So how did you know about blogging?
My friends were like, we're going to start blogging. And I was like, okay. Like back then, Zanga and LiveJournal were big, apparently. I don't remember reading any blogs that like stood out. But I mean, you think about the micro blogging that was happening on like Black Planet and stuff like that. But like I wasn't like deep into the blogosphere. I was just like, okay, my friends want to start this online journal. Let's do it. And that's what happened.
So tell us how you went from becoming a blogger in college, right? Because a lot of people say, oh my gosh, I want to be a best-selling author, but do I just start with a blog and then it just happens? I mean, how did it happen to you?
So I started blogging in 2003, got the new blog in 2006. I kept on blogging and more people just started seeing my blog and finding it and saying, you know, it was beneficial to them in some way or my words had some type of impact on them. I got laid off my full-time job in 2010, April 2010. And that's the last full-time job I had where I wasn't working for myself. Like, it was basically the chance for me to take this blogging thing seriously. I was doing social media consulting for small businesses and other bloggers when I got laid off my job, but I would still be blogging. I wasn't creating ads. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to do this thing, then this thing will come from it. It just was like people will read my site and share it with somebody that they know. And then that person shares it. And it grew from there. And I think the writing, I've always been a marketer, but the writing kept on coming right next to it. And yeah. And then I think in 2012, I got credentialed to do press coverage at the Academy Awards. From there, a lot of doors opened. I started getting columns and to write recaps. My scandal recaps got big. People will find me for one thing and stay for something else. And it's just like this snowball effect, ultimately. Like I was not necessarily trying to have a particular thing happen because I was writing. I think I was purely writing because I loved it. I was writing because it felt natural. Like it felt like if I didn't write, I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. I just kept getting rewarded for it. I got my first book deal in 2015 for I'm Judging You, the Do Better Manual. I wrote that book in 5 months that year. The book came out September 13th, 2016. And more magic started happening because the book hit the Times list at number 5.
Did you ever worry about money and supporting yourself, you know, after you were laid off?
Yeah, I definitely did. I think I was like, how am I going to make money, you know, doing what I'm doing? But I was like, you know what, I'm a hustler. That's where the small business consulting came in. I was like, I will, you know, help other bloggers do what I've already done for myself in terms of, because I built my own blog at that point. My marketing and communications background gave me the very specific experience that I could use to help other people. I definitely hustled.
Did you hustle to become a New York Times bestseller? I mean, how much of that was right place, right time versus the blood, sweat, and tears you put into it?
Most of it was blood, sweat, and tears. I don't think any of it was by accident. You know, I absolutely put and empowered book one and becoming a New York Times bestseller. I called in all my friends. I made sure that when they said like, how can we help? Let us know. I actually let them know. I powered that. You know, I made sure that the resources that I had available to me that I used them. Cause I think a lot of times we won't use it. We won't use it. We'll just say, you know, I got it. I'll make it work. And I'm like, no. For this, I knew how important it was for this book to succeed. So I was like, whatever qualms I have about asking for help, I'm going to make sure I ask for help. And that's what I did.
You bring up a great point. I don't think a lot of people understand what it means to ask for help, right? Because they're not exactly specific about how someone can help them. So what were the specific instructions or requests that you made of the people in your network to get the book to be so wildly popular?
One thing I was like, share it with the people you know. That's an easy one. But I also, you know, depend on who it was. If they were at a corporate level, I'd say, hey, you know, I'd love to come in and do a talk. Or if they had a particular connection that's in press, hey, I'd love to do an interview. I think I got really specific with how people could be helpful to me based on what they were already in, like the realm that they were already in. I wasn't asking people to kind of do something that wasn't natural to them. So all they had to do was say yes. They had very few reasons to say no. And I think some people got to share. Some people got to like make a phone call to give me access to something. I basically used my network because they already also trusted my work and they knew it was good. So they knew they were vouching for something good.
And now for a quick break.
So tell us about the time between book one and now.
The evolution. I think I've grown as a writer, as a person, as a thinker. I've gotten to do a TED Talk in there. I wanted to write when I felt like I had something to say. And for book two, I got clear about it after I did my TED Talk. I was asked to do my TED Talk 6 or 9 months after book one came out. And I was really busy at that point. And I turned it down because I was like, I'm not going to have time to focus on a TED Talk. And as I had like 40, 45 speaking engagements that year. So I said no. And because I also kind of was, I think I realized that I was afraid of bombing. 3 weeks before TED, I realized that I actually don't have to be at the 3% conference until November 2nd. And I was like, oh, I can go to TED for one day, the first day. So I hit him up and said, I'd love to get a pass to TED. And Pat Mitchell was like, well, if you can come, we want you to speak. And I remember I was about to send them an email. I was about to send Pat an email saying, oh my gosh, thank you for the vote of confidence, but that's going to be a no. Because that's crazy. That's 3 weeks away. I'll have to come up with a whole new talk. I don't think that's even possible. And I was about to send the email and press send, but I called my friend Unique. And I was like, okay, check this out. This is kind of crazy. TED wants me to speak there. I don't think I can do it. Like everybody else has already gotten all this practice. They've already gotten, you know, their talks figured out for months. They've already gotten coached for months. And Unique said to me, everybody ain't you. She was like, your coaching has been the fact that you've been on the stage every 2 days. The fact that you've been speaking for, at that point, 7 years. She was like, everybody's not you. So I need you to get off my phone and go write this talk. And I was like, well, okay. And I deleted the email to Pat. And I wrote my talk, not that night. I wrote that talk in an Uber on the way to another city that I was going to because TED wanted my script. When I sent them the script, they replied back a couple of hours later, like, we love it. Only a couple of edits, which was like, what? So I ended up doing this TED Talk. And with this brand new talk that I created, and it was like an out-of-body experience because I got on that stage and I gave the talk like I'd been doing it 1,000 times. Like, there's so many opportunities for me to bow out. But I wasn't allowed to bow out from my friend, from Pat Mitchell, who was a curator of TED Women. But I was just like, what happens? Like, how many times in our lives have we been these people? Like, how many times have we actually let fear stop us from doing what was necessary? So I felt convicted to write this book about it because I'm like, my journey is about the multiple times when I've been afraid, but I did it anyways. And it affirmed to me the thing that I'd already known, which is like, when I do the things that scare me, I win.
I think we both have a bunch of follow-up questions to this because it's so interesting. But I want to go back to the very beginning. And you'd said yes to 45 speaking engagements that year, but not the TED Talk. And you know, you've talked a lot about fear, but is that why you said no? Like, why was it different to give the TED Talk in your mind than to give these other 45 speaking engagements?
Because TED is TED. TED is a huge stage. It's a career changer. It's massive. Like, people who do TED official talks that go well, like, TED is one of the best things you can do for your career as a speaker. You know, and if you bomb on a TED stage, what does that mean for your speaking career?
So, Lovey, there's another person or another name besides Ted that played a huge role in this, and that's Unique. Mm-hmm. Who is she?
Unique is one of my really good friends. She is a cultural architect. She's also the creator of a game called Culture Tags. She's the closest thing I have to a coworker. We call each other with ideas every day. Like, we talk about life and work. And what she did was she loaned me courage, you know, in a moment when I didn't have any for myself or I was doubting myself. And she was like, no.
I love that phrase. She loaned me courage. That's a great way to describe it. And obviously it led to the Fear Fighter Manual, your new book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was an amazing moment of friendship, of people believing in you, even when you don't necessarily believe in yourself. Yeah.
Who else is on your personal board of advisors?
I have a crew of people, Bozma St. John, Justina Omokwa. I'm surrounded by people who are constantly giving me permission to be bigger.
Without giving away too much of the book, because everyone needs to read it, you mentioned when talking about overcoming that fear and getting on the TED stage that you've done that in so many other instances too. Like, what is another time where you could have let fear stop you, but you got past it?
When I spoke up about the Next Web, which is a conference in Europe, and how they wanted to pay me in exposure, it was definitely a moment where I realized that I was being asked to be who I said I was in public, also in private. And speaking up about it was important, because I think systems do definitely count on our silence to cheat us. And in that time, I was like, well, if I don't speak up, then who am I expecting to speak up? Like, is it the person who just started last week? Is it the person who has never been paid their fee? And I felt convicted to speak up, because whatever loss that I might face, I'd still be okay. So yeah, that thing, that was definitely another time where I was like, okay, I know I could face some real financial loss, but I think when we're asked to put our power and privilege on the line, yeah, those are usually the moments when we're afraid of losing something. You know, those are usually the moments when we wonder whether we are courageous enough. But I always think courage is a decision. So I made that decision. I think that year was my most profitable up until that point. I had more speaking engagements than I could count, and I had more inquiries than I could count. So it also affirmed to me that, like, we're often creating worst case scenarios in our heads and opting out of what could possibly be the best case scenario.
How did you meet your husband?
We met at a day party. I pulled his beard.
What? Tell us about that moment.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of my years of fear fighting. It was when I turned 30. And that year I said I was going to do some things that was unorthodox to me. Like, I was going to do some things that I would typically not do. And I went to this party, saw this cute guy walking across from me, and I pulled his beard, which surprised even me. And then that's how we met.
What was
his reaction?
He was like, "You just pulled my face?" And I was like, "I did." He was like, "Okay, I like it."
You are very strong. How would you have reacted if he had pulled your hair as a way of saying hello at the party?
I would have been pissed. For sure, I would have been pissed.
So is that how your relationship goes? The same rules don't apply to each of you?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. But in that moment, again, like, had he been pissed, I would have understood.
So it takes, I mean, we talk a lot about this on our show, about women and money and confidence and relationships. It takes a very confident partner to be in a great relationship with someone like you. Talk to us about that dynamic.
Well, I mean, my relationship is one I actually don't even talk about on online and just in general, because for me, it's my sacred space. And it is something that I hold dear as I live in this really public world and public everything. So I actually typically don't even talk about my relationship with my husband and my partner, because I'm like, it's the part that I actually don't want people to have access to.
So we've talked about, you know, we started the interview by asking what you were insecure about as a child. and you spend a lot of time talking about fear fighting now. Are there any things that you're still, that you're insecure about today?
Not that much. I think I don't spend a lot of time questioning myself. I try not to spend a lot of time doubting myself. No. I think I'm pretty much, I think I spend more time just kind of being like, okay, here's what I love to do. How can I get better at that thing? But I wouldn't necessarily call it insecurity, because I'm not constantly like, I got to get better. I'm not enough at this thing. So yeah, no.
How do you organize your days? You have so much going on, but I would imagine no day is the same. So do you create a routine for yourself?
The only routine I have is that I take lunch from 12:30 to 1:30 every day. That is the only routine that I stick to. I go to bed at different times. Some days it'll be early, depending if I'm tired. Some days it's late if I'm watching something. I don't have any real routines, but I do work for a lot of my days. I try to be done and off the computer by like 6, but otherwise my days always look different.
Do you work in your home?
Yeah. Yeah, I work for myself. And I mean, after COVID, we all definitely have to shut down.
Would you say that you have reached all of your goals, or do you keep making new goals?
I don't think I create big goals necessarily. Like I'll usually write a list of things that I want to get done that year, but it's actually a list that I forget once I write it. And then I revisit it at the beginning of the next year. And I'm always like, oh snap, forgot I wrote this thing. And I think for me, it's also kind of a way to take the pressure off. I also think I've spent a lot of time kind of trusting the universe to take me where it needs to take me. What I need to keep doing is doing what I feel like I love to do. Writing, marketing, storytelling, loaning people power.
And now for a quick break. Amy, do you want to go to the lightning round?
Yeah, let's do it. Levy, what are you reading right now?
Nothing. I'm in the middle of a launch. I'm actually reading nothing right now.
What's your favorite book that's not your own?
Toni Morrison's Sula.
Who leaves you starstruck?
This is a good question, because when I think of starstruck, I think about like who will I meet, who I start stumbling over my words and can't say anything. And my answer is nobody, because I've met those people and I didn't stumble over my words. So like maybe 5 years ago, I'd have said Oprah and Michelle Obama, but I met them. I mean, they're amazing women, but I approached them like regular people.
What's your morning routine?
Brush my teeth, get in the shower, get dressed, and then I sit down on my computer.
Are you watching any TV shows right now?
No. The last show that I did watch, though, was Your Honor.
Where is the first place you'll go when you can travel again?
Somewhere nice and beachy. Like, I need sand, water, and sunlight. A lot of it.
If you had $1 billion, what would be the cause you would want to give some of your money to?
Probably a racial justice organization that is working on policy and grassroots stuff. So I would probably want to spread that money amongst like 20 to 30 organizations that are all doing work that are interlocked.
All right. Well, Lou is coming for the final question. He's been listening to this interview.
Hi, Lovey.
Hi, Lou.
I'm a little starstruck, I got to admit. You know, I'm going to be straight up. One of the talks you did, it was the grind before the glow, you know, and I was thinking about me, like, because I'm a recovering drug addict, and I was like, my grind was bad, you know, but my glow is like so much better. Like my life is so much better, you know, based off of the decisions that I'm making. So I'm like, I did actually apply some of these things unconsciously, you know. So my question to you is, in your grind, what did that really look like?
I mean, it looked like hours behind a computer screen. It looked like writing and taking on opportunities and creating my own opportunities, writing for hours every day. There was a point where I was writing scandal recaps, and those recaps used to be 3,500 words. So like every Scandal episode, every Thursday, I would spend 3 hours writing this epic recap where like if you missed the show, but you read my recap, you missed nothing. So the grind looked like the unglamorous moments of staying up until 3 a.m. to finish this recap and spending my own money to go to conferences and just putting in the work that nobody saw, the pitching myself. Did I even pitch myself? I just kept writing. I just wrote a lot and just created content a lot. So that for me was the grind. And I didn't even have a team at that point. I didn't even have an assistant at that point. So I'm answering emails. I am my own CEO, COO, assistant, accountant. I'm my own social media manager, content specialist. So I'm running a whole company, but I didn't realize it. I just thought it was just me behind a computer screen doing what I had to do. So that's what the grind looked like. Negotiating stuff myself. It was a lot, but I think it was necessary because it prepared me for this moment.
Sam, I have to say that my absolute favorite part of our conversation with Lovie was her story about her friend that really encouraged her to say yes to the TED Talk when Lovie was so busy, had so much else going on. It's easy to say no sometimes when we're busy, when something's on the other side of the country, but we often need to realize that these things can be transformative moments in our career.
I think everyone needs a friend like that. We have played that role in each other's lives many times, even just recently. And I think that we all need that tribe of really positive people around us being like, you go for that. You got to do this. And I love that story. Now it's time to turn our attention to Project Entrepreneur's Jamie Sears.
Jamie, we are so excited to talk to you today. So we understand that you read Lovie's book and it's really been resonating with you. Can you tell us what your favorite parts are?
Yes, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you. And I love the book, and I will own that I am a professional troublemaker. I think there are two things that really resonated with me. One was doing things that are scary, acknowledging how scary things are and just doing them anyways, like, you know, being a part of a podcast for me. I think the idea of also really knowing who you are and how that can ground and sustain you was something I've been thinking a lot about, that just about identity and, you know, the impact of all of that. I will say that, like, for me, I am South Korean. I grew up in an orphanage and was adopted as an older child, you know, into a family in Western Pennsylvania. And, you know, fast forward, I've spent most of my adult life in the New York City area, working in social impact, on advancing equity for women and for communities of color. And I've been doing that for a while.
Can you share with us what that period was like? Do you remember being adopted?
I spent most of my years until I was 6 years old in orphanages and in like foster families in South Korea, in Seoul. And, you know, was fortunate because I was 6 years old when I was adopted. But the environment that I was adopted into, it was, you know, it's a blue collar rural town. I was very different in my hometown. And, but these are like, these life experiences have shaped a lot of who I am. And I think it wasn't until I was an adult and honestly had so much time to think across 2020. about how all these experiences have made me who I am and really has just given me a lot of strength to draw on. I think a lot of the reason why it's even on my mind is because in reading the book is, I think spending a lot of your life sort of feeling like an outsider, it can feel like it's not a strength. But I think what I've realized is that it really is. It has helped me a lot in terms of understanding others. You know, I wouldn't change anything, but it is, you know, it's a very particular set of experiences I feel like that have formed my identity. And now I'm, you know, I'm grown up. I have a son, a biracial child, and there's all kinds of things going on in the world that, you know, I think has me thinking lots about, you know, identity and how you draw strength from really knowing who you are.
How did the Pennsylvania family even find you in South Korea?
You know, in the 80s, there was actually a lot of adoptions from South Korea. It was actually one of the largest exporters of children back then, as weird as that sounds. So yeah, it was a lot of people came through one of two places, either Holt International, which is based in Minnesota, which is why you meet so many Korean adoptees from the Midwest, and then Catholic Social Services, which is actually how my family, how I connected to my family. And my parents, you know, after I was adopted 2 years later, we actually adopted three more girls from the same, you know, orphanage where I grew up. And so I'm lucky because they're like my best friends.
In talking about your childhood and the career that you've built, you do really hard things. You take on really big challenges. And as a founder, I have watched you and UBS support other founders in this really remarkable way. What have you learned from working with founders like me and like Sam about fighting fear?
Female founders that I've gotten to know have been literally my greatest source of inspiration. You know, on the entrepreneur front, I do think that women who start and grow companies are truly badasses, because, you know, women are not only, you know, starting out companies less capitalized, Black and Latinx women, especially so because of the racial wealth gap. But there's, you know, continues to be gaps in access to networks and resources and capital to be able to really build and scale a company the way that it has the potential to. So, you know, I know it's not for the faint of heart. I've seen it up close and have just been inspired by how women continue to be, you know, doing all of this, being, you know, the fastest growing group of founders, among the most productive of our time, outperforming all male founded teams, as research has shown. So I just really feel like if anyone can do this, it's women.
What opportunities are you seeing for female founders as we transition out of the pandemic?
There's a lot of reasons to be optimistic, but I will say, I mean, we've all seen that the pandemic has not been kind to women on a lot of levels. And when I look at venture capital and 2020, the venture capital has continued to grow, but startup investment into female-founded companies, you know, was down. At an ecosystem level, I think there's just a breadth of resources and community out there for founders. It's also been amazing to see all of these new funds that are being raised in the past few years, including 2020, that focus specifically on investing in underrepresented founders, women and founders of color. And I think this is a real recognition of the talent that exists, but is, you know, undervalued and underinvested in. And therefore, for investors, there's alpha there. So we will, at Project Entrepreneur, definitely continue to offer programming to get founders investment ready and build intentional networks and community to help them really grow and thrive. Seeing hybrid accelerator and sort of startup studio programs that blend in person and virtual is actually more flexible and better for women.
What industries do you think we should be looking out for?
It does seem like the industries connected to, you know, some of the ways that we work are going to be things to watch out for. What I mean by that is obviously there will likely be, you know, maybe more remote working and more virtual events and less travel and ways that people want to continue to connect, but might not be the way that, you know, we did in 2019. So things I think related to what we learned through the pandemic, I think are the sort of immediate areas of opportunity that I think investors are actually looking to.
What has this pandemic taught you about yourself, and how is it going to change the way you work moving forward?
I feel like this really proved to me that, you know, I'm probably more resilient and adaptable than I thought I was. I think we all just get really used to things being a certain way, things that we thought we needed to do in terms of, for example, one of the things for me was traveling a lot for work. And a lot of people have been talking about that because, you know, it took us away from being at home and if we have family and stuff like that. So I think that that has changed me forever because I have, you know, I've just so enjoyed being at home more and spending the kind of time that we likely will never have.
I know. Isn't that amazing? Amy and I talk about it all the time that we used to be on the road so often, and now I don't think we'll ever go back to that lifestyle the way it was, because you realize how much can get done without being in person. Thank you so much for being part of this.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer and editor, Laurel Moglen, our podcast associate, Phoebe Cranefuss, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.